there and welcome to a big, busy day of Breakfast All Day. The three of us are here, Christy, Alonzo, and Matt. Hello.
Hello.
Aloha.
We've got a full day of reviews and things to talk about, including we're going to take an early look at Shazam, which has not come out until next week, but it's really good, so we're going to talk about it. But we have to begin with some news and with some sad news, and that is the death of the legendary French filmmaker Agnès Varda. She was 90.
Yes.
Lived an incredible life for her 90 years.
She was, a key figure of the French New Wave, directed the film Cléo from 5 to 7, which was, one of the major works of that period. And really the main woman to come out of the French New Wave. I mean, we still are talking about the fact that there aren't enough female directors and the difficulty they have. So you can imagine she was getting started in the late 50s, early 60s. Mm-hmm. So she really, blazed a lot of trails for filmmakers everywhere, France and around the world. She married a New Wave giant, Jacques Demy. And they actually kind of had a Hollywood period because he came over to make Model Shop for Columbia, and she made several films here as well. And they always kept a house in Los Angeles, so they kind of, were very much both French-based but also L.A.-based as well. And then in her later years, she became a great champion of preserving Demy's films and making sure that they were preserved and remastered. So, if you own that Criterion Jacques Demy box set, which you should, you have Agnès Varda to thank for making sure that those movies were, digitized and all this stuff that kind of kept them from falling away. She also became this really extraordinary documentarian. Films like The Gleaners and I and The Beaches of Agnès and Faces Places a couple years ago. And what I found so inspiring about her is that here's a woman in her 80s who is not only still active and working, but embracing new technology. Like, she loved the tiny, digital cameras, and she was not afraid of any of it, and she didn't look down on any of it.
She was on Instagram.
Yeah, totally. she was very plugged into what was happening, and she had this insatiable curiosity about people, and she was always sort of just like open to meeting people. And Twitter today is like every film critic posting their pictures with Agnès Varda, because at some point you either interviewed her or you met her, and she was just like lovely and everything you wanted her to be, and her movies reflect that as well. And she was the first female filmmaker first female director to win an honorary Oscar a couple years ago. I was hoping that same year she was also going to win for Faces Places, which was my favorite movie that year. She lost. They lost the Doc Award to Icarus, but yeah, she's extraordinary. Her son Mathieu Demy is an actor, and I think their daughter, I think I want to say her name is Rosalie, is also involved in the film industry. But Agnès Varda is a legend, and go back and start looking at her movies, the old narrative films like Cléo from 5 to 7 and Vagabond and One Sings, the Other Doesn't, and then really check out the docs from the last couple decades, because they're all great. She had a piece at Berlin this year, so with staring death in the face, she was still making movies, and so she's an inspiration to us all.
Definitely. And I guess it was two award seasons ago where she and JR were everywhere with Faces Places. There was just this pure, radiant kind of joy for every new experience, and at a time in your life where it would be easy to be cynical and easy to be jaded and just tired in general. She was like a kid, and at the Spirit Awards, we saw her a couple of years ago, and she was like the rock star at the Spirit Awards.
When somebody asked her there, right, what's your advice for young filmmakers? And it was basically, if you don't feel like you must make films, then stay home. Right. Like, it's that very quickly says that, artists create because they have to create.
Yeah.
Right. Which I always thought was a great quote for her.
That's what I tell people about being a film critic. If you can do anything else, do anything else. She was amazing. She wasn't feeling well enough to come to the LA Film Critics Dinner that year, but JR FaceTimed her with the crowd, and she spoke from her home in France. I'm a great admirer, and I think, you know, she leaves behind an extraordinary legacy of film, but also her preservation work and everything else. And so, you know, let's pour one out to Agnès Varda. She's pour out some Chablis for Agnès Varda.
Oh, she's so cute. So that is the sad news that we have to share with you today. But then Matt also has some kind of exciting news to share. So Matt, take it away.
Yesterday we announced that Gray Drake, who I previously worked with at Rotten Tomatoes, is the new face of Movie Phone. She is Ms. Movie Phone.
That is so exciting.
I'm very excited.
So is she going to be the voice that you call on the phone? That's like, so, if you know the name of the movie you'd like to see.
So when we reactivate the phone number, yes, she will be.
Oh, amazing.
Oh,
so it's not just like a figurehead position. She's actually going to do the work.
Now I'm jealous.
Yeah, so she'll be doing that. We, you know, is it going to be calling up and using the robotic system? Probably not. But will there be some fun thing happening if you call the number? Yes.
Well, I love that she's doing all of this. She's going to be doing interviews and interaction with folks because she is a genius at that. Like, one of the most banal things in our modern world is the celebrity interview at a press junket. I mean, you've seen a million of them. They're in a hotel room. They got the poster behind them. They've answered the same question 10,000 times. It's super boring.
Right. There's a good view of that in
BoJack Horseman.
Well, in Notting Hill. Right.
Oh,
like,
yes.
Notting Hill has that great thing where you get a sense of, because, you know, you feel it from the, I mean, you don't think about this, but from the talent standpoint, they're sitting in that same room and they cycle all these people through who are all asking the same questions.
Yes.
Right. Or mostly the same questions. And not only that, in this day and age, they've all been coached to stay on message, real specifically staying on message. And one of the reasons, you know, amongst the things that's great about Gray, she'll walk into one of those rooms and, like, completely throw everybody off the script and do something completely different effortlessly.
She, I think, single-handedly figured out a way, like, how do I take this thing that we're all sick of but we all have to do and make it exciting? And so, I mean, she... You know, there was the legendary press junket that they did for The Force Awakens, where none of the press got to see the movie beforehand.
Right.
And they were still expected to do a day's worth of interviews with people who couldn't talk about what the movie was about. And Gray managed to get even the notoriously grumpy Harrison Ford to laugh by making him play the game Star Wars or Florida.
Star Wars or Florida. And she'd ask questions like, hermetic cult leader trains a young... teenage protege, Star Wars or Florida, right? That kind of stuff. She also had the rep for being, you know, kind of behind the scenes. She has the rep at a junket for being the fixer, in that if somebody's having a bad day, if somebody's grumpy,
they send her Gray.
They will bump Gray up in the order earlier in the day than they expected to have her. And
just to shake them up.
Just to shake them up and cheer them up.
That's
amazing. Yeah. And also, she can work a room. Like, we have done many times at various cons that Your Opinion Sucks panel, where film critics are on a panel and people in the audience ask them questions about movies and say, your opinion sucks. And Gray was always the MC of that.
Working the floor.
She can work the room. Like, she's got great improv skills, and she's very in the moment. Like, she has both done her homework, but she's also totally in the moment. And she just stands out with her fantastic hair and her great presence, and she'll be wonderful at whatever she does.
I am very excited for everyone to see what we're going to be able to do this year.
Well, it's a great get for y'all. So
thank you.
Well done.
Yes.
I'm thrilled about that.
Cool. We are also going to do some film reviews. It's an exciting day because we're going to do a review of Shazam! Exclamation point. It's a movie with punctuation, which I always enjoy. It comes out next week, but we're going to talk about it this week because we've seen it and it's good. And I suspect that you guys are also interested in it. So Shazam.
Oh, me? Okay, sure.
Well, I'm not going to describe it. I haven't seen it yet.
Matt, you're really going to like it, though, we think.
Okay, we may have to circle back then, because I do want to hear what Matt has to say about it. All right, so...
Somebody does.
So, young orphan Billy Batson has run away from a series of foster homes trying to find the mother who lost him at a carnival when he was a small child. Meanwhile, the aging wizard Shazam, played by Jaimin Hansu, has been spending years trying to find a successor. At one point in the early 70s, he pulls in a young child named Thaddeus Savannah, but rejects him. Savannah spends an entire life trying to find Shazam. Eventually, Shazam the wizard realizes that he can't be this picky and he's just got to find somebody. And so he bestows his power onto Billy. And when Billy says the name Shazam, he becomes a big strapping superhero played by Zachary Levi. But inside, he's still a kid. And yes, the movie knows you're thinking about Big, and they even reference it at one point. Savannah wants to strip the Shazam powers from Billy to unleash the seven deadly sins upon the world. Anyway, that's really not important. Ultimately, it is about a kid having to figure out how to be a superhero, even though he is a kid, and along the way, maybe learning the importance of family.
Shazam is an acronym.
It is.
I learned that. I think I must have known that somewhere in my brain, because I know I have seen that 1970s cheesy
TV show, yes.
There's the cartoon, and then there's also like the cheesy 70s live action show.
Yes. I did a panel at the Paley Center once with the guy who played Billy Batson on that show.
Wow. How was that?
It was great.
What's he up to?
I think he's a florist now in the Valley, but he was quite the teen idol at the time.
He was handsome. So yeah. Yes, Shazam is an acronym. It's like a bunch of Greek gods.
Solomon, Hercules, Atlas, Zeus, Achilles, and Mercury.
Yes, that sounds good to me. I didn't realize that. Anyway, this movie is just a joy. It's just fun, and it's playful, and it's so exciting that the DC movies keep getting more fun, right? They were known for being kind of dour, kind of self-serious, whereas Marvel would be a little more playful. And now the evolution from Wonder Woman to Aquaman, which was just goofy, to this, which like gets it right finally.
It's a good example of the amongst the terrible mistakes that Kevin Tsujihara was making while running Warner Brothers, because the directive to make all those movies super serious came from him.
Oh, okay. Well, this one's a lot of fun, and you cannot help but think of Big during it. And as you say, there's a bit of a bit. David F. Sandberg directed this, and he also did Lights Out, which was really fun. Remember that?
I did not see it. I did see Annabelle Creation, which was pretty good.
I feel like you saw Lights Out.
I saw Annabelle Creation. Which movie was Lights Out?
It is the horror movie with the home invasion with the guy who's blind and the young hooligan punks break into his house
because
they think
that's not Lights Out.
Yeah, it is.
No, that's Don't Breathe.
Oh, what's Lights Out?
Lights Out, that's not the Natalie Dormer movie, is it? No.
Wait, hold on. I'm going to IMDb. I was so certain that I knew it.
No,
Rebecca must unlock the terror behind her little brother's experiences that once tested her sanity, bringing her face to face with a supernatural spirit attached to their mother. Okay, so I'm super wrong.
Maybe I did see that.
Yeah, Don't Breathe was directed by the guy who made the Evil Dead remake.
Oh, Teresa Palmer and Maria Bello are in Lights Out. Anyway, he's made some horror movies.
Yes.
You can see my confusion, though, right? So it moves really well. It's very zippy.
Yes, it's poppy and it's colorful and it has a sense of humor to it. But it's not so jokey that there aren't stakes and they don't take the proceedings seriously. But I mean, if you go back and read the original 1940s like Whiz comics, they were, you know, it was a Superman ripoff, but it always had kind of a certain sense of silliness to it, even though the stories were wonderfully convoluted and complicated to get you back to the starting point always. You know, like this is a comic book that had like a talking tiger in it, you know, and there was a guy like Uncle Marvel who was this old dude who had the costume but had no powers.
Well, because we didn't really talk about the whole Captain Marvel thing, right? Because originally the character is called Captain Marvel.
Right.
And obviously,
because of a long, complicated legal battle.
Right. And so obviously, you can't have a major DC character called Captain Marvel, and Captain DC would be dumb because that wouldn't mean anything.
So now he's just Shazam.
But there was this whole offshoot. There was like a whole family, right? There's like
Captain Marvel Jr., Mary Marvel,
Uncle Marvel. Like there's the talking time.
And the movie does find a way to sort of tie into that stuff as well. I don't want to give anything away, but They do spend most of the movie not sure what to call him. Like, it's actually a joke where people on the internet will talk about him and they'll give him these names like the Red Hurricane or something, right. And so the movie itself doesn't know what to call this character.
They don't call him Red Tornado, do they?
No, because that's a different DC character.
But it also gets how it feels when you are alone and kind of isolated. Billy Batson is a foster kid and he's looking for his mom, and he's living in this foster home with a bunch of other kids who are surprisingly well fleshed out, and they're not just like precocious, adorable,
they have personalities,
misfit types. They have personalities, and there's this lovely kind of organic sense of family. It sounds like a mawkish sentiment, but it comes across really in a lovely way. It's a subtle, lovely way.
Like they have foster parents who genuinely care for them, who were fosters themselves and genuinely care about these kids, generally trying to give them a good home, but are not wealthy by any means. So, one of the great things about the costuming of this film is not just like the Shazam costume is great, but also like these kids all dress in a way that give them personalities, but they also dress in a way where it's like they have spent a lot of time picking the best stuff at Goodwill, and I'm not saying that as a shade. Like
good detail.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like I was reminded of Molly Ringwald's character in Pretty in Pink, who wore nothing but like thrift store stuff, but you could tell she had an eye for it. These kids dress in a way that underscore who they are, but they're also, putting it together that way.
Yeah. Zachary Levi is a blast in this. He's got this, cause he's a big dude. He's like 6'3" and a half. And so that works really well when he can, he tries to convey very effortlessly the idea of being a little goofy in that body.
The physicality of like, what the heck? Because I think for a 15-year-old to suddenly be, a 6-foot-tall man would be crazy enough, but to also be like a superhero.
Right. And
he's very ungainly. It's very funny.
He and Jack Dylan Glazer as the kid in the foster care who is like his best buddy. Is Freddie a real character in the comics?
Yes.
Okay, I don't know. I'll believe you. I trust you.
He's a newsboy in the original ones.
Okay. But they have a nice friendship. And again, like that is where the big dynamic. Let me ask you this. Was Big inspired at all by Shazam? I wonder.
The thing is, and maybe I just didn't read the right ones. My recollection of reading Shazam is that when Billy becomes Shazam, Shazam is pretty much like a grown-ass man and a superhero. And it's not so much the idea of like, I'm this teen boy trying to figure out this body. I think that might be something that the movie is adding, which works. It's completely organic.
It kind of depends on the writer, right? Like sometimes he's basically a Superman and he's, and then sometimes it's all over the place. Yeah, right?
There have been a lot of different iterations over the years, obviously. Like I've mainly read like the old sort of 40s and 50s ones. And then there was a brief period in the 80s when he was in the Keith Giffen Justice League.
Oh yeah.
Now that I think about it, there have been like miniseries and stuff that do play a little more with the idea of like he's a kid in
That's what they do in the Kingdom Come miniseries.
Yes.
Right. And that's how somebody actually ends up manipulating him because of that.
Well, it does make sense. And then in a couple of weeks we're also going to get Little, which is a female remake of Big, but with the roles reversed.
Right.
So that will be fun. We'll talk about that soon. So that idea, that kind of body swap idea is out there a lot lately. Yeah, I had a blast. I brought Nick with me. There is some stuff, if you're going to bring a kid, some of the stuff with the statues coming to life and the monsters, like the evil spirits. There's one scene in particular in an office conference room.
There are some mayhem.
Really violent.
Listen, office meetings are terrible.
Well, this is the actual physical manifestation of all that rage you feel during meetings, Matt. There's some intense stuff. If you're thinking about bringing little kids, I don't want the fact that this is playful and fun to suggest that like you can bring a 5-year-old to this, because it's pretty intense quite frequently.
There are a couple scenes where they kind of lose sight of the tone. And then, of course, they do so in a way that's PG-13. So like there's mayhem, but it's bloodless. And it's like, what are we even doing here?
But intense things happen to people.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I agree with you. And so I think if you can work past a couple of those moments where they sort of drop the ball in what this movie is aiming to achieve and usually achieving, I found it quite lovely.
I think age eight or nine and up is good. So I'm giving it an 8.3. I had a really, really good time at this. So you're hearing a lot of hype. I feel like the hype is justified.
Yeah, I give it an 8. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, so 8.2 is our number. It's at 93% on the tomato meter. And perhaps at some point, Matt Achety, you can see
perhaps.
It. We think you're going to like it. So come back and tell us what you think.
Okay. Don't tell me what to do.
Okay, you guys.
Can I say it?
Yeah, if you want to.
Can I ask if we're ready?
Are you? No. Because you're gonna ruin that bit.
Oh, okay.
There's a bit in Dumbo that is like a point of no return for this film. And I don't want to ruin it because it must be experienced.
And then they do it twice.
And then they do it again. All right. But we're getting way ahead of ourselves. We're ahead of our ears. We're tripping over our own ears here. So. Alonzo, please describe to us the live action Tim Burton Dumbo.
Okay. So... we begin with Colin Farrell returning from World War I with one arm. While he was away, his wife died of influenza. So it's a Disney movie. His kids are grieving. They are still living in the circus where he used to work, where he and the wife had a double act as horseback riders. But now, with the one arm, he has been relegated to taking care of the elephants. The ringmaster of the circus, Danny DeVito, has just acquired an elephant who's about to give birth. And when she does... her child has gigantic ears and everybody thinks that's bananas. And he is mockingly named Dumbo. But then, of course, it turns out the kids figure out that if they can make him sneeze, he can fly. This is Act One. So that's how the cartoon, the good one, ends. Now this movie has to figure out what it's going to do for the next hour of running time.
Right, because let's remind everyone, the first movie, the original movie,
it's
is
like
what?
70
like,
minutes.
64.
64 minutes. So enter Michael Keaton as an evil theme park mogul.
And the theme park is all art deco and futuristic.
Who has nefarious designs on basically buying up the whole circus just to get his hands on Dumbo. I saw this movie like 2 weeks ago and I barely even remember what any of the motivation
also,
for anything is.
Then clearly Alan Arkin was wandering around on set in a tux doing a different movie and wanders in for a couple scenes and then wanders out.
I said that in my review, like all of a sudden Alan Arkin wanders in from an entirely different film and like does some shtick and leaves. It's bizarre.
You can't control your animal.
And I'll tell you, parents, you'll be thrilled to know that Dumbo and his mother are separated not once but twice in this one.
Having said that, I did not cry enough.
I didn't cry a jot.
I got teary-eyed that first time, and it's not a spoiler, guys. It's in the trailer, and it's in the animated movie when the mama trunk comes up and the baby trunk and they intertwine and they kind of whimper at each other.
In the cartoon, devastating.
Totally. I got teary-eyed during that part, and Nick is sitting next to me going, are you crying yet? Are you crying yet? Because he likes to make fun of me. And really, I should be... in a puddle of sobs.
Here's my question.
Yes.
Did you cry because this movie was presenting it effectively, or did you cry out of nostalgia for the old one?
Good question.
Did it just remind you of a scene that did make you cry?
Maybe. Or it's just like that hormonal thing that's still in there, I guess, as a mom, like all this time later, like the idea of having my little boy ripped from me, like that's really sad.
I wish someone would rip my little boy from me. He's a monster. That's coming when he turns 15.
That magical age.
So all I know is that if I'm not crying, you've done something wrong. This is a pastiche of better Tim Burton movies. And it's impossible not to think of everything that this is reminiscent of. Beginning with, early on, the Danny Elfman score is flat out the Edward Scissorhands score. It is nearly identical, which is one of Tim Burton's best films ever. And that score is still so haunting. So you are repeatedly thinking of a better film that should be tugging at your heartstrings. And the fact that it takes place in a century-old circus is big fish all over the place with Danny DeVito as your ringleader, you know, which he was in that film as well. And then you have Michael Keaton, who has been in such better Tim Burton movies as Beetlejuice. You have a little Batman Returns reunion with him and Danny DeVito. So over and over again, you are reminded of how inferior this is. And they really have stretched out this idea of a film, but then they haven't developed the characters to carry that story along.
I didn't care about anybody. And You're right. This is a movie that should have so been in Burton's wheelhouse because it's about a hero with an unusual physicality who is at first mocked but then later understood and loved for its poetry and its right. soul.
He's a classic Burton misfit.
Yeah,
yes.
And they don't do with anything with that. You would think that the circus milieu would give him the license to really go crazy with the art direction or with something, but it feels kind of safe and familiar. I mean, even the front the front panel of the Casey Jr. train looks like the Shrek's department store logo from Batman Returns. When you think of better Burton, you're looking for it in this movie and you're never getting it.
The Colleen Atwood costumes are quite lovely, especially everything that Ava Green gets
sure,
to wear.
Yes.
So there's that. I mean, the great Colleen Atwood. You have all of his longtime, you know, collaborators here and they all know what they're doing. But again and again, it's like, I've seen that and I've seen that and that's been better elsewhere. And yeah.
This movie is terrible. I think they make a big, big mistake not letting the animals talk, right? Not that Dumbo ever says anything in the original film, but not having Timothy, who is basically a Jiminy Cricket type right. character, like not doing that, I think I get why they're doing it, sort of, except that we got talking animals in the Jungle Book, so and we're going to get that in The Lion King.
Having said that, the visual effects are kind of jumpy here, so I'm not sure that talking would have helped. Like there's like a jerkiness to the flapping that's really distracting and off, so talking have helped? I don't know.
I thought the actual Dumbo character was pretty well faked. I mean, I didn't notice the jerkiness so much, but you're right. I think there's a fundamental problem with these Disney remakes of their movies. These movies are usually musicals, and the new ones feel very skittish about doing that, unless it's Beauty and the Beast, where they just do it up, you know. But like Jungle Book, you'd get these snatches of some of the songs, and here you get like a little Pink Elephants on Parade.
Right.
And
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think the songs from Dumbo are some of the best songs from any, like, that's one of my favorite of the musicals. Like, those sure. songs are terrific.
Unfortunately,
like,
you can't bring those crows back.
No, you can't bring the crows back. I get that, but Casey Jr. and Pink Elephants and, you know, Baby Mine.
When I See an Elephant
right,
Fly. When I,
right. Like, those songs are terrific songs. And it's that they completely abandon them is frustrating, right? You get the musical cues and, you know, they do a little bit of, like, you know, similar to what we saw in the Jungle Book, where there's you know,
snippets.
One or two of the snippets, you know, like the greatest hits. And, you know, there's references to them. But I think that's a mistake here. And then so it becomes dependent on this story of the father reconnecting with the kids. It doesn't help that I didn't really particularly care for the performance by the daughter.
You know who that is? Nico Parker. That's Tanya Newton's daughter.
It looks exactly like her.
I wish she had more to play. I wish she had more of a character. But there's just a quiet, regal bearing to her that I like.
I like her presence, totally, yeah. But I think it was Angie Hahn who said on Twitter, liking science is not a character, even if it's a girl.
Right. She wants to run away from the circus and join the lab. Like,
I like that. At least they give her that,
right,
but that's all
that,
she gets.
Right. They give her that.
The little boy gets nothing.
But then they kind of like... By the end, though, that's not like they, you know, someone like, oh, no, embrace what the family business is. Like, I just thought this movie's a mess. And it's just like this catastrophic series of terrible decisions. Right. and again, like, you know, the thing that I was hinting at.
Oh,
and,
my God.
Right. There's a particular announcer that shows up. And once you. Right. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
And
I don't want to ruin it, but
I'm not going to ruin it. But
it has to be experienced
because so. When you see this person, when you recognize the way they talk, you're like, oh, okay, how's this going to work? And then when they do it, you're like, oh, God.
We're not going to go there, are we?
Right. And then we get it again.
Oh, my God.
And it's like this doubling down of terrible decisions, right? Like when you get Eva Green flying on Dumbo, and that's not a spoiler because we've seen that in the trailers, the effect on that is so bad and so awkward. It looks like Cosby riding that ostrich in Leonard Part 6.
Ooh,
like,
wow.
That's how bad it looks.
That's a very specific reference.
Thank you.
The thing you're talking about, Matt, though, it's such a glaring anachronism. I don't know why anyone thought it was a good idea because like it or not, in a Tim Burton movie, they will go to great lengths to make all of that detail like period specific, and they try to create for you this world, and then by having a really cheesy pop culture reference, they just yank you out of that world, yeah. And it's irreparable. I don't know why that was a good idea.
And they brought him out to the premiere and had him do it there, too.
Oh, my God. Cringe,
cringe. I got it three times.
Yeah, cringe, I mean, cringe.
The other thing, too, is you know, for the time that it's set is, like, what, 1919, yep. I think, right? Yeah. So they're doing, you know, the references, especially, like, this World of Tomorrow kind of thing, this theme park has got references to futuristic visions that people weren't doing in that style in 1919. Like
that was like the '50s, right?
Well, but it was also like, you didn't start seeing that till the '30s, till like the '20s and thirties. Okay. Right. So there's references to the way they're talking about rockets and the way they're talking about
like the kitchen of tomorrow,
right? The kitchen of tomorrow. Like nobody was doing that until about 10 years after that. Like as somebody who is, like, at least not to that extent, right? You may have had hints of that, but, like, you know, sure. Point to the Art Deco design and the Fleischer Superman cartoons, but that's later than this. That's later than 1919, right? And it's, and so the references aren't consistent.
The futurism wrong.
Right. And that's really frustrating. Because the futurism at that point, like, sure, we talked about this coming out of the movie. Like, if they wanted to make it look like a trip to the moon, great, mm-hmm. right? Sure. Like, that's the way I would have bought that. But they're making it look
George
like
Millie's
right. I really was.
The main problem here is that the human characters are completely uninteresting. Yeah. I mean, we don't care about Colin Farrell reconnecting with his kids. We don't care about the potential love interest that he winds up having. Michael Keaton is basically playing like Keenan Wynn in an old, like, 70s Disney live action movie. I mean, that's the thing. And I said this in my review of The Wrap, that, like, you know, Dumbo is this sort of beautiful story of an outsider and you know, of you know, having to prove your worth and all this stuff. And the movie reduces it to being, like, Million Dollar Duck or Gus, where we have an animal who can do this crazy thing, and now this mean guy wants to steal him, you know, and it's like...
Also, right. I'm kind of baffled as to what Michael Keaton is doing here, because it's a weirdly off performance.
Mm-hmm.
The accent he's doing is off.
The sunglasses do all the work.
The wig is terrible. Is he really evil? There's like a goofy spin he puts on the character that kind of undercuts the true deep villainy of who he's supposed to be playing.
Yeah, because there's moments where you're like, okay, mm-hmm. maybe this guy's all right. Like, but then you don't get disturbed by, oh, I shouldn't have been trusting him at all.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, he can play that kind of character who is dangerous and yet charismatic. He's done that for quite a bit of his career, including in Beetlejuice. And I don't know what happens. Like, that, all that instinct in him that makes him interesting has been tamped down.
Yeah, like, I mean, he could be doing this the way he played Ray Kroc.
Yeah, right. That's a good analogy. You know, it's very similar, yeah. So, yeah, Dumbo's not good. Yeah. I'm giving it a 4, and that feels high.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was clearly in a generous mood when I saw it. I gave it a 4.5, but it's, yeah, don't bother.
Matt.
3.
Okay, our number's a 3.8. It's at 54% on the tomato meter, wait for Shazam.
Yeah, there you go. Totally.
We are playing a little bit of catch-up now with a movie that Alonzo and I have seen.
Yes.
You say that like... You're disapproving.
I'm not shaming you. You're not Ben. You've seen a lot of movies this week.
At least I'm here.
Yes.
And your dog is here. Sabrina's at our feet beneath the table. Sorry. So 5 feet apart, Alonzo, please tell us about this sad, weepy YA movie.
Oh, boy. Okay. So Hayley Lou Richardson is a teenager with cystic fibrosis. She has gotten very good at organizing everything and kind of compartmentalizing and sort of just making, you know, being super on top of her meds and her treatment and all this stuff. And she has a friend on the ward, you know, they often find themselves hospitalized at the same time, who's a gay guy, who's, you know, her age, and they're buddies. And then one day we get the arrival of Cole Sprouse, a.k.a. Jughead from Riverdale.
A.K.A. half of The Suite Life of Zack and Cody.
Also that, yes. And he's, you know, he's like, he's the rebel. He's the bad boy. And, you know, at first she is put off by him, but she eventually just, like, cows him into, like, doing her bidding because he's on this experimental treatment program, but he's not really, like, taking it seriously. And she's like, dude, you're lucky to be here. You're lucky to be getting this program. So, like, you know, she makes charts for him and gives him schedules and does all this stuff. And once she whips him into shape, then suddenly he starts subtly convincing her to, like, break the rules a little and, you know, like, get crazy. And, you know, the rule for people with CF, according to this movie, is that you have to stay 6 feet apart so that you have, you know, compromised immunities and you don't want to give each other your bacteria. And, you know, like, her act of rebellion is they're going to be 5 feet apart.
I want one more foot. I'm taking it back.
Exactly. And, you know, and it's another sort of Fault in Our Starsy kind of movie. And I've seen some really great pieces online by people with CF.
Oh, interesting. What'd they say?
Oh, they hate this movie.
Interesting. What, yeah. Because they get the disease wrong?
Well, no, they say that they get a lot of the details right, but it's ultimately pity porn. Mm-hmm. That it's all like, oh, these, you know, and somebody wrote a great letter to Linoleum Knife this week about the movie. She was like, nobody thinks of their own life as tragic. You know, like, yes, if you have CF, most likely your life expectancy is in your 20s or 30s. That's just the realities of the thing. But people don't sit around and stew in that all the time. Every teen crush doesn't become Romeo and Juliet because one or both of you is dying, you know.
It's very intense, and they've got to cram it all into this little space. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what saves this? I mean, yes, it is... It is beautiful, dying teen porn, as always.
In, like, the nicest fucking hospital ever.
They have giant hospital rooms, like, giant private hospital rooms.
And in this day and age, when it comes to, like, how shitty healthcare is in the United States, like, you might as well... This should be set on a resort on the moon.
Well, listen...
Like, how inaccessible this is to most people.
It is a tragedy if you are comfortably well-to-do enough to afford the giant private hospital room that you're dying young.
I mean,
well, Claire Forlani is his mom.
Yes.
So whatever she does, we don't really know a whole lot about their family. So
right.
Whatever Claire Forlani does, if she can afford the nice hospital room and the special trials that he's doing.
And, you know, there are a couple lines that acknowledge this. Like the gay guy talks about how one of the reasons that he doesn't keep a boyfriend is that when he turns 18, you know, he's going to be off his parents' insurance. He doesn't want to burden whoever's in love with him with suddenly having to deal with his upkeep, you know. But for the most part, yeah, they, you know, they're in this incredible hospital that has, like, a meditation room and a pool and all this stuff. And Haley Lou Richardson is the reason this movie isn't a total waste of time.
She is adorable, and she is so good in everything. If you have not seen Support the Girls, please go see that. And she's great in Columbus,
yes,
which was this wonderful indie from a couple of years back with John Cho.
And The Edge of 17.
She's really good in that. And she just brightens up everything she is. She has this wonderful quality, this effervescence about her, this accessibility about her. So even with this kind of mawkish material,
she has a way of de-bullshitting it.
Right. And she and Cole Sprouse do have some nice chemistry with each other,
sure,
you know, a nice, easy way with each other. It's pure formula as to what that is at the beginning and how it evolves to what it's going to become. Mm-hmm. So there's not a whole lot of surprises here. I mean, yeah, if you like this kind of movie, if you like, you know, as you say, The Fault in Our Stars, and there's also what, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, uh-huh, and there's Everything, and there's Midnight Sun. There's all these movies about people with weird diseases who can't go out in the sunshine in the daytime.
Yeah, because teenagers all feel like the death is just around the corner anyway. You know? So I get there's a certain, like, melodramatic appeal to that sort of thing. But
and this uses the technology, I guess, in a way to just, you know, contemporize all that, because she does a lot of her videos on YouTube, and that's how he gets to know her better,
right,
because of her having, you know, documented her journey and all of that.
Like the heroine of eighth grade.
Yeah. And, you know, it's okay. I mean, I think for what it's trying to do, for who it's trying to do it for, it's fine. Mm-hmm. We are not its target audience.
No, certainly not. And again, I've even heard some of the CF people talking about how, look, we do not get a lot of representation, and so we're starved for it. But it's annoying that people are going to, this is going to be their takeaway. This is the movie we get because so much of it is so mawkish and absurd. But I mean, yeah, her performance is so good that she, like, just elevates this thing to where you don't completely hate watching it all the time.
Yeah. So what is your number then?
I give it a 4.
I'm saying 4.2. Our numbers are 4.1, which are both under 5. Haha. Because it's 5 feet apart. So they have to stay my height apart. I'm exactly 5 feet tall. So if I just, like, laid down, and they could be on my foot and my head, and they could still not touch each other and live.
Well, they wind up walking
around.
No, they
pass germs through you, right?
It's like a human centipede situation.
Oh. They wind up walking around holding opposite ends of a pool cue. Uh-huh. Like, that's their measure.
That's Do they sweet. Have to always make sure they're holding the same end, though? Because if they switch ends...
That's true.
Oh, that's true.
That's true. Anyway, so it's a kind of predictable teen weepy. I, in a ghoulish way, guessed how it might end.
What's the old saying? People who like this sort of thing will like this sort of thing.
So now we're going to turn from the exciting blockbusters we've been talking about to something small and kind of lovely. It's a film called Diane. And it is the narrative feature directorial debut of Kent Jones.
Yes.
Who was a film critic.
Yes.
For a long time.
And a well-known curator and programmer in New York City. And then he also did the documentary Hitchcock Truffaut, right?
Yes. Yeah. And he was at the Film Society of Lincoln Center, I want to say.
Yes.
So this is his first narrative feature. And it stars a completely lovely Mary Kay Place as a woman named Diane. And she is, what, in her 60s?
Yeah, that seems right.
And she's widowed, I would say. I don't know. She's not married.
Yeah.
Find out more as we go along here.
Yeah. At the beginning, we see her as somebody who has a full plate in terms of family members. She's, you know, visiting a relative in the hospital who has cancer. You know, she's got various aunts and who she's, you know, helping out and taking care of things with. Her son, who's played by Jake Lacy, has some issues of his own. She volunteers at a soup kitchen, you know,
yeah,
a lot of stuff.
I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things I really like this movie, and this movie sneaks up on you.
Mm-hmm. It does.
And it starts out in a quiet way, like, because you start out, I found myself like, I wonder where this is going. Mm. And Mary Kay Place Diane is this woman who is just matter-of-factly being what would seem on the surface really selfless and really put upon. She's got a son played by Jake Lacy, who's, you know, we're seeing a different role from him, and I think he's good in this.
Very.
Playing someone who's totally strung out and really messed up and, you know, keeps calling her names and kicks her out of the house, like, but she keeps coming back to try and take care of him, and that gets deeper. But in the beginning, you see her dealing with her son and visiting her cousin in the hospital who's got cancer and volunteering, and she's doing favors for everyone. And it's very much like, oh, this is someone who just gives and gives and gives. And you kind of start expecting like, oh, she's going to snap. And that's not where the movie goes. Right. And you start to see that there's something akin to atonement, that's why she's doing this. And as you learn more, and you learn it in a very organic way, I felt like you learn more and more about her character and why she's doing all this. And I really, really loved this movie. And I'm going to end up changing my score to a 9.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Like there are no sort of almost no Oscar clip moments.
Right.
But it's such a great performance. She's so inhabits this woman's skin. And Diane is the kind of woman that in life you might just sort of assume that you know her deal or not really right. even think about. And the movie just kind of, again, very organically, very subtly lets you know who she is and where she's been and what she's done. And it's fascinating.
And there's at one point where, you know, and they talk about, like, there's a scene around a kitchen table with all these other relatives and friends, and they're all very much older and talking about people that they've lost and, you know, kind of some discussions as to, you know, being careful because you're getting older and there's a point at which Diane or somebody discusses with her who she's lost. And she says, you know, one of the last relatives is this one. And at one point there's a funeral that totally catches, like, me, it was my reaction to seeing who it was. I was like, oh no.
Me too.
Right? And I was like, and that's when I realized, like, oh, this movie has me. This movie has me really invested in Diane in a really subtle, sneaky way, because for me to find out that's what she's going to do, I was like, oh.
It's just really beautifully written. I mean, there's just great subtlety to, and an efficiency to all of these interaction she has, right? And she's constantly doing for others, and it's her life seems rather mundane and kind of bland on the surface. But then if you listen to what they're talking about, they convey so much in just the simplest of conversations at, you know, the country buffet, eating bland mac and cheese or whatever it is that they're having. There's a really rich sense of place here. It takes place in Western Massachusetts, like Pittsfield, Mass, I want to say. But it could be anywhere in any small town on the East Coast. It's kind of bleak, and you get the sense that it's a place that has seen better times, and there are references to all the husbands who have died,
right,
and why.
Right. One of the other things I think this movie does really well is it shows how in families, and I think about this fairly often, there's a, you know, like if you're going to get in an argument and get really pissed at somebody, if they're not a family member, like there's a whole dance of escalation that happens before people really like raise their voices and act really angry, right? Before the gloves come off. But with family, because you've gone through that escalation so many times, you don't do that anymore. And so you can just turn on the like, God damn it, you do this all the time, like that, yes, right? And this movie catches that in a few different places, and it doesn't feel forced, and it just feels so natural, and you totally believe it. You know, there's one of the scenes in the hospital where she and her cousin start arguing,
yes,
over what seems like an offhand comment, right? And then it gets real ugly real quick, right? And then there's the dinner at the Sun's.
So great.
Which I thought was great. And the way that scene is cut, it's right at the edge of being farcical with the other comments that people are making,
right,
but it doesn't tip in there. Like, the director walks that line so well. I was really impressed.
I want to just rattle off the amazing ensemble cast.
It's incredible.
Yeah. Estelle Parsons, Andrea Martin, Deirdre O'Connell, Glynis O'Connor, one of my favorite actresses of the 70s, who's been surfacing of late. Like, she was in Bread Factory. She's in this, just so terrific. Joyce Van Patten. You know, just like all these amazing actresses and you know, Jake Lacy. And yeah, I mean, this is a movie about working class America that never feels like it's about working class America. Right. Like, it doesn't go for any gigantic statements, but it is very, it is acknowledging, yeah, like, the, you know, there's that conversation about all the husbands who died from the same thing, and that probably was at the factory or wherever it was they all worked. You know, there's, you know, there is an opioid issue in this movie. There is healthcare issues. There is all kinds of stuff happening. You know, there is the use of religion as a substitute drug. You know, there's a lot of things going on in this movie, but this is not a movie about issues. Ultimately, it is about these people, especially about Diane herself. And Mary Kay Place brings this woman to such vivid life. It is a great, great performance, and I hope that people remember it at the end of the year.
I suspect they will at the Spirit Awards,
because
this is the kind of place where, you know, the kind of performance does get acknowledged,
totally,
and should.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so subtle what she's doing, but you're right, Matt. When there are like the flashes of totally human anger and exasperation, it just feels not out of place, but rather like we're watching a complicated woman living a life. She has lived a life, and she has regrets, and we feel like we know her so well that when she does deviate from the saintly persona that she puts out to the world, it's like, oh, of course, of course, because we know her by
then.
When
she lets that other woman at the soup kitchen have it, it's like,
right, right, or the scene in the bar. Right.
Oh.
When she comes out of the bar, right?
Oh.
She comes out of the bar, and then you're so happy to see the way that scene kind of ends.
Yeah.
Look, a lot of movies will use shortcuts and they'll use broad strokes to kind of signify what a character is doing. And this movie earns your affection for Diane. And again, totally caught me off guard until that one particular scene and, you know, at the funeral. And at that point, I was like riveted, because then it was like, as the rest of the movie went on, you know, between the writing is great, and just that this movie will quietly let us see the life of a woman who is not just reaching the end of her years, but living through everyone around her doing that.
Right.
And that's, you know, and not in a overly tragic, like giant sweeping way. This is just a thing that we deal with, and she's, you know, dealing with her own regrets of the past, and I love this movie.
Ken Jeons is exposing this character, not like, if he's an archaeologist, he is not using a pickaxe. He's using that brush.
Yeah.
The brush, 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 brush.
And between this and Gloria Bell, it's been kind of lovely to see movies recently that explore the complicated interior life of middle-aged women, and, you know, their joys and their triumphs and their regrets, and there's such truth to it.
And Greta.
And Greta's going through some stuff. Ooh. And sometimes she snaps, and that makes sense too.
She just wants to dance.
Yes, and also the ending is really lovely. It's yes. a beautiful, yes. perfect
oh,
ending.
God, yes.
So we're all saying 9 then.
Yeah.
If you're raising yours to a 9,
yes.
okay. So 9's our number. It is at 97% on the tomato meter, and it's probably just like New York and LA this weekend.
Yeah, but it's IFC Films, so
this is worth your time.
Yeah, if it comes to where you are, go see it. If it's streaming soon, wherever it is, do not sleep on this one. This is a
it's a wonderful movie.
This I think has a decent shot of being on my top 10 list.
Yeah, the last cool. thing I want to say about this is the type of movie that like makes me glad that we do what we do, because we you know, I'm so glad you said that we should watch this, because this is that kind of movie that, look, my own particular tastes run towards bombastic action figures and or action pictures and sci-fi movies, and I would have overlooked and I would have totally overlooked this movie, and I'm so glad I watched it. Like, this is such a great discovery, and I would recommend, this is that type of movie, like, this is why we watch movies. For me, it's like, oh, this is terrific. This yeah. I will get the energy to watch a whole bunch of just forgettable garbage, because every once in a while you get a diamond in the rough like this.
Cool. We talked about a lot of great movies this week, and now we're going to talk about The Dirt. Matt, describe it.
So The Dirt is the story of the first 20 years of Motley Crue, the metal band that basically ruled the Sunset Strip in the 80s. They, you know, kind of put a band together. They've come from different bands. They get together. They've got a whole sound and scene that they want to hit. They hit big really fast, and as we've seen over and over again in the E! True Hollywood Story.
Which is essentially what this
right?
is.
Then the descent into drugs and alcohol.
I miss VH1's Behind the Music.
Yeah. And so, that's that one too. So, you know, things go sideways. We see them, you know, kind of as you get glimpses of their family life. We see them, you know, look, it's not a spoiler that Vince leaves and comes back. And, you know, this movie, I didn't hate this movie. I went into this thinking it was going to be garbage.
And it,
you know,
wasn't?
It's based on
their book,
which is giant. It's this huge, huge book, and they've managed to cut it down in a way that, like, it's okay. I thought there were some interesting choices here that I was okay with, and I think there's moments where there's actually a little bit of emotional impact, and there's some places in here that I thought, you know, had some laughs, but then there's a little bit of, like, it's almost like it's not raunchy enough.
It's very raunchy.
No, it's very raunchy, and it starts out like that first scene.
Yikes.
Right? That first scene in the apartment is like, oh, God. Right? And they...
Well, it's from Jeff Tremaine, who has directed a lot of Jackass movies.
Right.
So it's on brand for it to be that kind of, like, scatological, gross-out movie.
So, you know, and then you get, you know, this scene at the pool with Ozzy Osbourne that's just, like... I'm not sure some of those crazy, over-the-top stories you hear about rock stars you really want to see on film. But
again, that's the Jackass part, the stuff he's
right,
doing.
Right. You know, but then I found, like, the scene where, you know, where Vince Neil's in the hospital room with his daughter, I was like, you know, and then later you see him kind of, you know, talking to the rest of the band about that. Like, that kind of worked for me.
It is really tough to make the tonal and emotional swings that Jeff Tremaine tries to make. He's not up for that task. Most directors would not be. And especially in this setting where it's trying to reinforce all the cliches about a band like Motley Crue. Basically, Alonzo, you know, this is like Jersey Boys, like a really raunchy version of Jersey Boys, each of them takes a turn at talking to the camera and saying, look, that's not the way it went down. Here's how it really went down.
Yeah, I didn't see this yet, but when I heard about the perspective, my first thought was Jersey Boys, which the thing they abandoned very quickly in that movie. But after hearing Winter Mitchell describe this on Pop Rocket this week, my takeaway is it sounds like Decline of Western Civilization 2 as filtered through Rock of Ages.
Oh, it's not nearly as bad as Rock of Ages.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no.
It's just, it looks like crap. Like, the lighting is super flat and hot and bright, and it just feels like they're playing dress up. You know, and at the end, you see, during the credits, you see side by side what they actually look like, what Tommy Lee and Nikki Sixx and Vince Neil, right, and all of them look like. You see that a lot of trouble, you know, they went to a lot of trouble to recreate specific pairs of pants or specific hair, right, and makeup, or like the pattern, like a zebra stripe pattern on a guitar or whatever. But that's not filmmaking. That's not storytelling. That's just like, look, we look just like them and we're doing raunchy stuff like they did. But you don't, they're all caricatures of these real life people. And it also reaches a point where we're supposed to celebrate them for being crass and raunchy and misogynistic and, you know, just, you know, all the rock and roll cliches, the sex, drugs and rock and roll backstage and all that. But then there's, because there's so much narration explaining to us what's going on with them, which isn't terribly complicated, we have to learn, like, oh, we're really a family. We're all about family. We stuck by each other no matter what. We're a family. And then, you know, Douglas Booth as Nikki Sixx, who is so pretty. He's way prettier. Looks back at the camera with like a knowing smile, like, yeah, we're family, man, before they all take the stage together. I also like Motley Crue. Yeah. I think they're a shitty band. And I mean, again, I like some shitty hair metal from that time. I like Def Leppard. I will acknowledge that.
Okay.
Motley Crue's music is terrible. It's not hard.
There are no Whitesnake.
There's a joke about Whitesnake in this movie, though, actually.
Yeah. I'm not a huge Motley Crue fan, but I didn't mind this movie. I think a little bit of his, I found, for right or for wrong, I think the guy playing Tommy Lee, Machine Gun Kelly,
yeah,
the rapper, mm-hmm, is, he's got this goofy charm that he actually gets real close to, kind of like when you see Tommy Lee talking, there's also kind of like that, there's a goofy charm to him.
He's tall and lanky like Tommy Lee. Right. He's got that.
But he's also kind of like, he managed to be tall and lanky and then kind of just this like, not quite, I don't want to say well-meaning bozo, but like there's a vibe not far off of that. If somebody who is that dirty can be, but you know, do they gloss over things like his domestic abuse? Yes, they do.
There's no Pamela Anderson, right, in here.
But you know, again, I've seen worse. I didn't hate this. Granted, let me be clear. I don't think this is a great movie. But I didn't think it was unwatchable. Like
borderline. Yeah.
Look, again, you know, if you like Motley Crue and you want to get a glimpse, you know, or a recreation or have a kind of idea of like what it was like, and you're not looking for the hard hitting kind of truth and, you know, warts and all story, then you're going to be okay with this. You're actually going to enjoy this. But if you're looking,
very shallow.
But if you're looking for something that's like the untold story or like gives you really deep insight into them, I don't know that you get a lot of that. Although I do find it interesting, like some of the early conversations that they have, especially when Nikki Sixx says, look, like the punks are doing this minimalist thing, so we're going to go in the opposite direction and we're going to give people a show. And we're like, there was a specific like plan as to why they had that look the way they were doing. And I thought that was kind of intriguing. Like, I was like, oh, all right.
Is it fun trash?
No.
I thought it was kind of fun trash. I guess that's, yeah.
I like fun trash. I do. This is not that. Also, like, every single woman is a naked, fuckable piece of meat.
True.
Except for Heather Locklear, who gets to keep her clothes on.
Yes. You're right.
And again, like, is that an accurate reflection of who these guys were then? Yeah, probably. I don't doubt that it was actually like that. But then, don't turn around to me and say, we're all about family. We love each other, man. What we're doing is important. Like, no, seriously. Like, they want us to actually care.
I don't think they thought what they were doing was important.
Well, I don't know. They do think that. I mean, and there's a title card at the end saying, Motley Crue stayed together until 2015, until they played their final show. And then you see footage of their final show. Okay. Part of the problem is that they are all still alive, and they're all producers on this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, this movie, we're right. Like, that's the thing is I went into this like, oh, they know this. They know this story. They had sign off. Like, okay, but here's the question. Is it better or worse than
Bohemian Rhapsody?
I was just thinking that to myself before you posed that question. I think I'd rather watch Bohemian Rhapsody. If only
to listen to Queen.
To listen to Queen and only for the Live Aid scene.
Okay.
All right. But it is kind of like that thing like everyone forgets that Walk Hard exists because this hits all the music, all the music biopic cliches with like narrating what's going on. Like, we lived a block up from the Whiskey Go-Go.
Oh, yeah.
And our apartment was the place to be. The cops came so many times they had to nail the door shut.
So everybody went in the window.
Everybody came in the window. I mean, it is explaining to you things that you are seeing on screen. This is not a very complicated script here. Again, do you want a complicated script in your Motley Crue biopic? Probably not. Maybe the material matches the shallow, shrill nature of their music. Maybe that was the point. Maybe it was an active artistic choice. Either way, it sucks.
Okay.
All right. So I'm saying 2.
I did not hate this nearly as much as Christy. I give it a 5.
Our number is a 3.5. It is at 42% on the tomato meter. It's on Netflix. If you want to watch it,
you're already paying for it. So, you know.
Right. As far as something like, if I had to go out to the theater and watch this, I'd be bummed out. But like, I get to sit home and watch it. Like, okay.
Fair enough. Thanks for watching. Like this video. Subscribe to our channel. Follow us at BeFastAllDay on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Subscribe to the podcast and keep an eye out. We'll be talking about a Patreon very soon.
And in a few days, on Monday probably, I'm going to post my latest a la carte interview with my good friend Phil Johnston, the Academy Award-nominated co-director and writer of Ralph Breaks the Internet. He also co-wrote the Oscar-winning Zootopia, and he co-wrote Wreck-It Ralph, and he wrote Cedar Rapids, and he's a great old friend of ours. We had a really fun conversation, so I look forward to posting that in a few days. So look out for that.
Cool.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.